Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome back to The Wonder, science-based paganism. I'm your host, Yucca.
And I'm Mark.
And this week, we are talking about the darkness, the dark, which, of course, for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, we are quickly approaching the winter solstice. So it seemed like a really appropriate time to dive into this.
Yes, and this is a really rich, really complex conversation we're going to have. This reaches into culture, into biology, into astronomy, into a whole different range, evolution, whole range of interesting topics. And to be honest, we're only going to hit the high points in this conversation because there simply isn't enough time to say everything that there is to be said about the concept and experience of darkness. But we're gonna try. We're gonna do what we can for you. So hold still, brace yourself, and here it comes.
Yep. So let's actually start with that astronomy and earth science side of it. It can seem a little bit self-evident to say, but really important actually to think about. We are part of a little rocky planet that is orbiting a star. And we live on one little part, each of us individually, on one little part of the surface of this planet that is continuously spinning. And half of the time, our side of the planet is facing the sun. We talk about how the sun rises and sets. That's not really what's happening. We are turning towards and facing the sun and then turning away from the sun. And for half of the time, we're facing it. And there's light and warmth. And we, as diurnal animals, are instinctually more comfortable. And half of the time, we're facing away. And no matter where you are on the world, half of the time, it is night for you. Whether that's 6 months and 6 months of the year, or 12 hours each day, or whatever your latitude is, half of the time it's night.
Yes, yes. And what that means for us as animals that evolved in order to live a diurnal life is that we don't have some of the benefits of animals that live in the nighttime, the nocturnal animals. We don't have the nictitating membranes inside our retinas that help us to capture more light so that we can see in the dark. We don't, and particularly as humans, because our intelligence and our opposable thumbs were what we really selected for at the later stages of our evolution, we don't have very good senses. Our hearing is not terrific. Our sense of smell is not so great. So we don't have a lot of the perceptual tools that would help us to navigate a darkened world very well.
Yeah. So there's a very deep instinctual part of us that, as a species, and of course there are individuals who are different, but as a species, we are more comfortable with the light.
Yes.
And there's another element to this that I want to bring in, which are, as creatures of this planet, we have an internal clock. We have a circadian rhythm that's based on these day and night cycles, the light and the dark. And this is an area that many cultures have had an intuitive understanding for a very long time, but that modern science is only just starting to put the pieces together on the whys and the hows behind it, and trying to understand how our hormonal cycle ties in with all of this. Because our internal clock is not quite 24 hours. Turns out it's a little bit more than that. So we require the sun, the light and the dark cycles, to reset our clocks. And our clocks dictate so much for our body. It releases hormones, which are hormones are basically little messenger chemicals in our body that tells events to happen, that tells processes, okay, go ahead and start, right? We have the melatonin, which is going to tell us in the evening to, or when the light starts to fade, that it's time to start all of these processes that are going to lead to sleep. We've got adenosine. We have all of these things. And so many of them are light dependent. So we can really change our experience of the world by changing our experience of light and dark. And that's something that we have been changing a lot in the last 100 years.
Well, I'm going to demur a little bit. We've been changing it a lot for the past 200,000 years.
That is true. Yes. So
Homo erectus domesticated fire, that was really the beginning of human incursion into the darkness. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, we can kind of imagine these primate creatures terrified of predators coming for them in the night, huddling together and just kind of doing the best they can to tough it out. But that was all that was available to them. Maybe they set watches. We don't know. But all that we have is the recognition that as soon as the opportunity presented itself, we domesticated fire, and we have not let go of fire ever since. In fact, yeah, we have expanded the meaning of fire and the extent of what constitutes fire into our cultures universally ever since that time.
Yeah.
So
and today in a modern urban setting where you might look around your house and go, I don't see any fire. If you follow back, where's your electricity? Where's your stove? Where's all of that coming from? You're going to wind that back and you're going to find that we're burning something.
Yes. Yes. And fortunately, we're moving away from that, I believe. I mean, we have wind energy and we have solar energy and all those kinds of things. But the truth is that in every one of those cases, the end product is something that's being heated to radiate either light or heat or both. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's what our incandescent light bulbs are. That's what our natural gas heaters are. All that kind of thing. And so we have thoroughly domesticated fire mm-hmm. by this point as Homo sapiens, and especially in the last couple of hundred years, thoroughly, thoroughly domesticated fire. And one of the primary reasons that we did that was not only so we could cook food to break down the proteins so that we could assimilate them more quickly and feed our hungry brains. And it was not only so that we could have culture and develop relationships with one another around the fire after the time of gathering food during the day. It was also just to push back the scary blackness, mm-hmm. the scary darkness.
Yep. And so building on that with the last few hundred years, there's been some new advances with gaslighting and now with the electric light bulb. But with those, and particularly with the light bulb, we've been able to erase night in urban settings. Within our homes, even in rural settings, we're blasting light. And that cycle that even though we may have had fear of it, that is built into our very biology to need. Because without the dark, our hormones don't work right, our sleep doesn't, and it spirals from there. And the sleep is, I mean, it can't be stated how important that is to our bodies and to our mental health.
Yes. Yes. If you want to make someone crazy, keep them from sleeping.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, it's well established that if you really want to destroy someone, their personality, prevent them from sleeping.
Yeah.
And in order to sleep, we need darkness. That's why people wear eye shades on airplanes. It's why people, it's, and it, not only darkness, but also, and I don't want to go into this a lot, but also relative silence, mm-hmm. a lack of input of sensory data, which is what you tend to find in a natural setting at night.
Yeah. There's a stillness for us. There's other animals that are nocturnal and that's when they're doing their thing. Mm-hmm. But for us as large diurnal creatures and a lot of the creatures that we partner with, our livestock, our dogs can go either way, but the dogs will usually do whatever we're doing,
right.
That we tend to partner with diurnal beings. And so our social part quiets down.
Yes.
Even if the crickets are awake and the bats are doing their things. And yeah.
Yes. Those are things that we can tolerate. So, so darkness is so important to us in terms of keying our internal calendar and our internal clock so that we know when to go to sleep and we can get really deep and effective and restorative sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really key piece in terms of understanding the importance of darkness for us as biological beings. Culturally, the overculture of the society that we live in, the Western, so-called Western civilization, which of course Gandhi said would be a great idea. what do you think of Western civilization, Mr. Gandhi? Well, I think it would be a very good idea.
Yeah.
Darkness, scary darkness, right? You know, the monsters live in, the scary darkness that we fantasize about as children and so forth, has been conflated with all things that the society doesn't like, doesn't value, doesn't respect.
Mm-hmm.
And that has included urges, like sexual urges, right? Violent urges, all of those things that the society finds threatening, those are dark urges. And most perniciously, and we need to talk about this today, most perniciously, this has been conflated with people with dark skin.
Mm-hmm.
The idea, and there are people who use that Mark of Cain claim out of the Bible in order to rationalize the idea that people with dark skin are inherently marked as somehow less moral, less ethical, less of value. And it is disgusting. It is a terrible, terrible thing. And it is still everywhere in our society.
Yeah. Right. There's the folks who consciously say that, but it's everywhere. It permeates our normal language that we use every single day within everybody, people who are very conscious about wanting to be anti-racist, and it is still in our language. It's invisible to us.
Yes. Going to the dark side, embracing the dark side of the force.
Mm-hmm.
Our cultural products, like our movies, are filled with this, you know, the black hat villain.
Mm-hmm. Dark magic, black magic.
Dark magic.
Our dark feelings.
Yes. Yes.
There's a dark cloud over, yeah.
Right. And all of that, when you really step back and think about it, is pretty arbitrary. There's no particular reason to characterize that with a light level.
Yeah.
But particularly in the English-speaking world, where we defined the acceptability of slavery based on skin tone, over the past centuries, 400 years, this has become something that is commonplace and is still, it's still with us. And we really, really need to resist it. It's it's such a challenge because it's, you know, it's the fish to water. It's what we're swimming in. This is the culture that we grew up in. It's the language use that we associate, you know, and when we talk about someone's dark urges, we all know exactly what we mean by that, right? We mean something bad.
Yeah. Right?
Well, dark isn't bad. We as humans, as diurnal animals, are less accomplished in negotiating literal darkness, meaning lack of light.
Yeah.
But that doesn't have anything to do with the sort of metaphorical meanings of darkness that are applied in our cultures. And it is so important that we break away from this and understand that when it comes to skin tone, black is great. Black is terrific. There's absolutely nothing wrong with black, brown, various shades of golden and tan, whatever all the colors are, up to the, you know, blazing white of those who live with albinism. They're all fine. They're great.
And I want to add in some other terms that we use that it's associated with a lot of this. Elevation as well, higher and lower. And we'll use that with the directions because we decided that up and high is north, which is really because the people making the maps wanted to be on the top of the world. But that's another place in our language where an expression I hear all the time is things went south. And when you stop and think about that expression and go,
What's wrong with south?
Yeah, what's wrong with south? What is actually being said there? And it's connecting back to the things that we have said are bad, the dark, but also the earth. The urges that you were talking about. All of these things, that anything that we have decided as a culture is negative, is something that's earthy, dark, primal, all of these.
Powerful,
yeah.
Because darkness is scary, right? And it's not scary if it's not powerful. If it doesn't have the capacity to really mess you up, then it isn't necessarily dark, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that higher and lower thing is another assumption in the overculture, which I'm happy to say I've seen a lot of pushback against in the pagan community.
Yeah.
This idea that your spirituality is elevated above your sexuality, for example. I mean, it's funny, we're talking and I'm making these gestures up and down. I'm so accustomed to it, right? You know, like the chakra system, for example, which starts, you know, at the tailbone, at the anus, and then works its way up to this, you know, sort of super spiritual lotus flower on top of your head. I mean, that expresses a set of prejudices. It says that there are certain things which are, well, they're necessary and you got to have them. But ultimately, if you transcend all of that, you can be a being of pure light.
Yeah, away from the earth, into disconnect from the earth.
Yes. And I want to be on the record as saying, I don't want to be a being of pure light. I don't believe that exists. And even if it did exist, I wouldn't want it. I want those aspects of myself that have been tarbrushed tarbrushed, right? Another
right,
term.
Yeah.
Yep. That have been negatively characterized as less worthy. I want to be the being that I am. I want to be this animal living this life. And I want to embrace all of the nature of what being this animal living this life is. I don't want to tell myself stories about how I have to transcend my quote darker unquote urges.
Or shadow.
Shadow urges in order to be a better person. All of that, I think, is poisonous.
Mm-hmm.
There are the parts of yourself that you are more comfortable with, and there are the parts of yourself that you are less comfortable with. That doesn't make them good and bad. It doesn't make them dark and light. It doesn't make them higher and lower or more elevated and less elevated. It just makes them parts that you're more comfortable with and parts that you're less comfortable with.
Exactly.
So as we talk about living with this challenge that we have in relation to the human experience of literal darkness, the night, coming up at this time of year, for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, it becomes very natural because our days are getting very, very short and our nights are getting very long. And so it becomes, and metaphorically, for people who are living a pagan cycle like I am, this time of year metaphorically equates to that time that comes after death, right?
Mm-hmm.
The composting and the pregnancy and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, birth at the winter solstice. So it becomes very natural to contemplate the miracle that happens in the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
That is the piece that I think the overculture completely misses. The spectacular things that happen under the soil, right?
Yeah.
Because that's as much a thing to skip around the room about and go, yes, 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 as anything else that there is here on Earth.
And you have to have the darkness part for that to work, because we like this things popping up in the spring and the new life and that, but you can't have that without the rest,
right? And the rest is all stuff that's been labeled as dark, right? I mean, everything from excretion to create food that you know, plants grow in that the new life springs from, right? To sex, which is this sort of inchoate, you know, process of alternate consciousness, because there's all these chemicals happening in your brain. And there's a lot of kind of almost automatic programming going on where you're not as much in control of yourself as you might ordinarily hope to be. Mm-hmm. All of those things which can make us very uncomfortable and you know, to feel very a little scared about it because we're out of control, right? All of those things are absolutely necessary in order to bring that new cycle of life. And so the darkness is sacred.
Yeah.
What we can discover in the dark is miraculous. What we can see in the dark, when we get all that light pollution away and we can see the cosmos above us, you know, right now Mars looks like a bright copper penny and Jupiter and Saturn are getting so close to one another.
Oh, yeah.
Verge at the solstice. There are just miraculous. And,
well, wonderful timing this year, isn't it? For those folks who are listening, so Jupiter and Saturn, they're really far apart, right? They're about 500 million miles apart. But when we are looking at them from Earth, they look like they're pretty close. But what they're doing right now is that the way Earth, Jupiter, and Saturn are going to line up, it's almost as though right around the solstice that Jupiter and Saturn are practically touching. They'll look like one point of light from our eyes. And then if you happen to have a good pair of binoculars or a telescope, you can start to investigate that further. But it's just one of those magical moments.
Yes. And it hasn't happened for 680 years. Galileo saw the last one, is my understanding.
That wouldn't work out.
No, that wouldn't work out though. For the 680 years, would it?
Yeah, let's look up how it's been several hundred years at least since it happened, but I don't but
no, yeah, I'm wrong.
16,
it's 680 yeah. years until it'll happen again.
Okay.
That was it.
Well, let's look up the, yeah. So it's a very rare event for us because it has to do with our perspective of them.
Yes.
Yeah. So just amazing. But that was a little jump away. And of course, Mars that you can see as well during the evening. Right now, the Geminids are happening as well, mm-hmm. if you're out, which wherever you are in the world, the best time is about 2 a.m. But anytime after midnight through dawn, it's one of the largest meteor showers of the year, and just amazing to get to be out. And you can't see them unless you turn your phone's light off, you turn that porch light off, and you sit in the dark and let your eyes adjust.
Yes. Yes. I want to talk a second about a ritual that I've done with various different ritual working groups over the years. I proposed this many years ago, and it's a thing that's kind of gotten incorporated into the ritual practices of a couple of different ritual groups that I belong to. And the idea there was that for our solstice ritual, the first thing that we would do, the very first thing that we would do, is that we would all get a hot beverage of some kind. You know, hot cider or something like that. And then we would go outside and we would sit in the darkness for half an hour to 45 minutes in silence and experience the cold and the dark and the sky and all of those things that are happening out there while we're huddling inside for warmth, drinking eggnog. And then it was time to go inside and light candles throughout the house and bring the light back and all that kind of stuff. But at first, the important thing was to really get the deal with darkness. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, this is what darkness is about. And I've been fortunate that there have been some places where I've been able to go where it's literally been pitch black. On years when it's been moonless, you could not see your hand in front of your face. And that is, I don't know if you've ever been spelunking in caves or any of that kind of thing. True pitch blackness is a profound experience. It's extraordinary.
So it's very common for us to go straight from the screens of our phones to trying to sleep. Or even leaving the lights on or a television on or something like that. But if we think back to our ancestors and how our bodies evolved, what we were doing, we had in the winter, because in the summer it's different depending on, again, you know, how far north or south you live. But we would have a period of time where we have turned away from the sun, where it is dark, where the light that we had was firelight, which is still pushing back the night some, but it's a very different quality of light. It has that flickering, it has that almost trance-inducing time. That hour before you actually go to sleep can be a really wonderful time to invite the darkness in. And even if you can't be in a situation where you can literally just turn the lights off, one thing you can do is get an orange or red bulb and have a different color light. So you're not using that blue light. Use an orange light that mimics that firelight a little bit, but also doesn't have the blue, because the blue light is what in our eyes we have receptors that as long as they're sensing blue light, they're telling the melatonin not to be produced. Mm-hmm. So it's about half an hour after we stop getting blue light is when our body then starts to really kick up the melatonin production. So if you can, invite you to try it out. Set aside the time before the sleep to feel that quiet that stillness, that darkness, and investigate what that is in you. What are you feeling there? Not just what's all of this bright, shiny, engaged stuff that we have on this storytelling, social, energetic level, but slow down and see what's going on with you.
Yes. Yes. And it will not completely solve the problem. So I'm not saying, that, you know, you should do what I'm about to say in order to, you know, transcend all problems with the screens. But there are settings on computers that are called nightlight settings, and they will reduce the amount of blue once it's late in the day. They will reduce the amount of blue light coming from your screens. It is well worth turning those on.
It's, yes, it's huge. If you have Apple devices, it comes built in. Some of your other devices, you can just download an app and just have it set to do it automatically.
It's built into Android as well, and also into Windows PCs.
Yeah, the new Androids, I think they're calling it's Comfort View.
Yes.
And it's a little icon that looks like a book. So it's like a little open book, and it's right there when you swipe down. So that is really big. And while we're talking about the light, I just want to put just a voice for the insects and the nightlife for a moment. Our outdoor lights, our lights are a pollutant, and it is really harmful. So it's hurting our bodies, but for the rest of life, I mean, it's really harmful as well. And doing things where you have a motion sensor light for your porch can be really helpful, remembering to turn it off, or switching the color bulb. You might not want to use a red bulb because that has some historical context to it, but you could use an orange bulb instead, and that will make a huge difference for not attracting and confusing our nocturnal community members.
Very good point. Although I would go one step further and say, don't have a motion sensor light. Just don't have one.
Well, if you need it for the safety element you're walking out. So for instance, I live in rattlesnake country.
Oh, I see.
Gotta have in the summer, you absolutely need to see where you're stepping. It is a literal life and death situation. And if you're in an icy environment and you want to be able to see the ice, but if you are in a more temperate environment where you don't have those same restraints, then by all means, you know, avoid the light when you can as well. But yeah, but recognizing that people are in different positions in terms of what is, there's, what's that expression? Don't let perfection be the
enemy of the good.
Yeah. So do what you can, right? And yes, and let that step, and don't worry. So
I have. There's an outside light outside the door of my house that is apparently on a circuit that is not a part of my unit where I live. I can't turn it off. It's just there all the time, and I keep taking the bulb out. And every once in a while, the landlord replaces the bulb and I take the bulb out again. And it's just like, no, I don't want to be a part of, you know, contributing to this light outside. I'm not afraid that someone's going to burglarize me just because I don't have a light outside my house. That doesn't work for me. Mm-hmm. But it is considered kind of normal in our society to have these blazing lights outside during the nighttime. And I mean, I understand the point of streetlights. There's good reason for there to be streetlights, but I'm glad that I live down at the end of a dark street that doesn't have many of them.
Yeah.
So I guess what I would say at this point is that I wish you all of the benefits of darkness. I wish you engagement and embracing of those aspects that are that have been labeled as dark unfairly, and hope that this podcast has helped to cast a little bit of a different light on the darkness so that we can all understand it better and have a much better relationship with it.
Yeah. And get out and go see those Geminids.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't forget Mars. Mars is a bright red thing right now. It's
you
amazing.
Can't miss it. Yeah.
It's so cool.
Yeah. Even if you're in a city with a lot of street lights, you should be able to see Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in the evening hours.
Yes. All right. Well, it's been wonderful having this conversation with you, Yucca. I always enjoy talking with you about anything, really.
Likewise. Thanks, Mark.